Shut up and sit down.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Sinister Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Hurley, and I'm joined as usual by our guest host, Ed English. Ed, how are you?
For the judge of the living and the dead, it's me. How are you, Joe?
Ed, I'm looking forward to this discussion on The Exorcist for a simple sole reason that I have never seen The Exorcist until you told me we're watching it, and I watched it last Friday during the day, which you gave out to me for.
During the day with the lights on.
Yeah, absolutely the most accurate way to do it. Okay, The Exorcist, 1973, directed by William Friedkin, written by William Peter Blatty. It's got an IMDb rating of 8.1 out of 404,000 votes, and the Rotten Tomatoes review is 84% of fresh, which is the 86 reviews from the critics, 87% audience score, and the consensus is The Exorcist rides its supernatural theme, the magical effect, with remarkable special effects and an eerie atmosphere, resulting in one of the scariest films of all time. Ed, why The Exorcist?
Why The Exorcist? Because it's one of the scariest films of all time. It's got to be in the top five, and it's so clever and so deep, so well shot, so atmospheric. Some stellar performances, some really, really great casting from relative unknowns. Mm-hmm. And it takes what is really quite a simple story and layers it through with themes like faith and hope and darkness. I think it's a fantastic film. It's got an iconic soundtrack. And it's, you know, it's one of those things, as soon as you hear that, those couple of notes on the piano, you know exactly where you are, you know exactly what the movie is, and you know you should run for your life.
So when you were growing up, like, as I said, this completely escaped me and my real experience with it. And this is obviously probably why it kind of has fallen foul of me over the years, is because I only remember the spoofs of it, like things like Repossessed with Leslie Nielsen, the piss taking scary movie or whatever it was. And it was never really on my radar to watch. I remember there was a documentary on BBC years ago, and they were talking about like how people were getting sick in the aisles and all this kind of thing. And I asked my mother about it, because my mother's scared of her own shadow. And I said, "Did you see it in the cinema?" And she said, "Yeah." And I said, "Were you scared of it?" And she was there, "No." So I was always kind of
lie.
Yeah, it's absolute nonsense. There's nothing to be scared about here at all. Ed, what is the story of The Exorcist?
So the story, at its very, very simple part, is about a 12-year-old girl who gets possessed by a demon, and then the two priests who have to exorcise that demon. But it's added complexity because of the interplay between the characters involved, right? So the girl's mother is an atheist, a very successful woman, rich, powerful, all of that good stuff, but ultimately completely powerless in the face of this demon and this thing that she doesn't understand, juxtaposed against the two priests who are involved. Father Karras, who's a younger priest, he's a Harvard trained psychologist, Harvard, Brown, Yale, all these kind of good places, John Hopkins. And as we meet him coming into the film, it becomes apparent that he's losing his faith. So we've got this priest who's struggling with what he thought was going to be his life's work, and then they smack a layer on top of that, whereby they kill off his mother and fill him with loads of that lovely Catholic guilt that he wasn't looking after his mother properly. And that's really just laid on with a trowel. But it works. It works well. So we have him in the middle of it, and he's very skeptical about the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And then you have the older priest, who's an experienced exorcist, who's, you know, it's alluded to that he's done battle with this thing in Africa, and he's been through it, even though it nearly killed him. And he absolutely believes, absolutely, 110% total faith in everything to do with all of this stuff. And you've got these three kind of layers, and I think those three characters interplay really, really well, and you see this journey for Father Karras and for Regan, who's the 12-year-old girl, her mother, as they go from, she's getting every kind of medical test known to man done. Some of those scenes are quite shocking, actually, before the demon ever gets involved. Mm-hmm. Like the scene in the hospital with the blood pumping out of her neck. Jesus Christ, this is 1973. This is not ER. George Clooney's not coming in the door here to save her. Like, and there's that scene, and gradually they go through after test, none of it works. And one of the doctors says, why don't you try an exorcism?
Yeah, so exactly. She's gonna have to call. We're out of ideas here.
Yeah, you know what? Let's call in a priest and hope for the best. It's a real Irish solution. Send for the priest.
All I kept thinking of, especially towards the end, was the Father Ted line. Is there anything to be said for another mass?
I'm still going. And then on the other side of the coin, you've got the journey of Father Karras, who's pretty much lost his faith, can't help his mother, not understanding why this stuff was happening to him. And then he's brought on this journey from a man who should have faith, but is in a position of skepticism, into the position of, oh, good Lord, there's something going on here that I can't explain, and I've tried. And then he sees the older priest, he gets killed by this demon, and then he's all in. And I know that's the very climactic moment of the film, but for me, that's the point where he really goes, oh, this is real. And
very late in the day, it's kind of thing.
It is a little bit late in the day, but he got there in the end. So it's the interplay and the journey of those two or three characters that, for me, that's what makes this film fantastic.
And when you look at it nowadays, like, I went to see the movie Smile last week, and like, horror films nowadays have descended really into just jump scares. That's all it is. There's nothing more than that. There's no suspense. There's no build up. There's no, like, the sense of ambiguity is gone, because what happens is in movies nowadays, it's basically, you'll see a random person will just pick up some form of, like, you know, a kind of a demon or something like that. And they'll always find, like, a book in a library that'll say, like, this dates back to the 4th century and all this kind of thing. And in this film, there is lots of ambiguity. There is so much stuff that you do not see, and it's up to you to decide yourself what has happened. Like, the death of the film director in this movie is not explained. It is not even shown. It's not, like, there's suspicions of what happened, but it's just, he's in the movie, then the next scene, he's dead, he was at the bottom of the stairs and his head was twisted around. And as a result of this, what is really kind of scary and intimidating about this movie, I think, is that it is very much all realistic. And we spend over 2-hour film, the exorcism only consists of the last act and is only the last 30 minutes. And all of it before then is basically a mother basically going through all the ways of saying, what is wrong with my daughter? She goes to the doctor, she goes to the hospital, she goes to psychiatrists and all that kind of thing. And it's all about the corruption of the innocent. But the question, I suppose, that to you is, in terms of how scary it is, what element of, I suppose, scare in it has held up so well?
So I think it's that, you've hit it in the head, it's that ambiguity. And that's an intentional trick from the director. Like, he leaves the room early, and there's still stuff going on in shots, you know, and you can only hear it and things like that. And that the guy getting the film director, who is an Irish guy, by the way, an Irish actor, and died 2 weeks after the making of the film, you never see his death.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, again, completely intentional. So that you're not sure. It's unclear. You never see the death of the older priest. Father Karras comes in the door and he's lying on the floor dead. And Regan is sitting in the corner, the devil sitting in the corner going, what you make of that, kid? How you like me now?
That's right. That's my work over there. That guy is absolutely dead. And the thing is, like I said, because of the fact that there's no death in it, like, again, I think it goes back to something like Hitchcock said before about movies, that it, like, it's not there to scare you in the cinema. It's there to scare you when you go home at night.
Yeah.
And a lot of what he wanted to do with scaring was, he wanted your mind to fill in that blank yourself, because if you see it, it takes away some of it, because your greatest enemy is your own mind for what you will create as being the... And thing is, you will never just decide one thing as being that's what caused it or that's what happened. Your mind will completely, you know, make up loads of different scenarios, each more terrifying than the last.
That's the Steven Spielberg thing, you know, for the love of God, don't show them the shark.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't
yeah.
see Jaws until the end of Jaws. And that's completely intentional. Like you said, that's gone from modern horror, I would say, by and large. I mean, when you get past maybe like The Ring and The Grudge and The Blair Witch Project, I can't think of another film after that that does it so well. Well, The Blair Witch Project didn't do anything for me personally, but I know it did for a lot of people. But it's those kind of films that play on your mind. Like,
when did you last watch The Blair Witch Project?
Probably not long after it came out.
I'd actually say go back and watch it again.
You think?
I watched it again in the last couple of years, and I was like you see, I was turned off by the audience, by the trailer saying this is the scariest movie ever, and then I went to see it.
Turns
and like,
out. not so much.
But see, as Irish people, we're intentionally going to go, no, we're not going to be scared by this nonsense. But
no matter what.
Effectively, yeah. But I watched it back years later, and I was there going, wait a second, this is actually really good, because it's a constant... Sorry, this is now turning into a commentary on the
Blair Witch Project. Sorry about that.
Sorry, it was completely apologies for it. Okay, hang on a second. I have to ask you this question then, Ed. What exactly is the situation with the opening scene in Iraq that goes on for ages, and then it just...
How would you like to open your movie with 10 minutes, 12 lines of dialogue, all of them in a foreign language, foreign chanting, and goats and camels walking around on the screen, right? That's how we'll open this film, and we'll suck you right in.
Because, like...
You know what? It's weird. It's weird. Like, weird, in inverted commas. But it works. Like, there's... I was sitting watching it the other night, and it's playing on your mind, and you're like, what's going on here? What's this about? What the hell is that about? Why is he climbing up on that? You know? I thought it really, really... It works really, really well, and then he pulls the little... The little demon head out of the hole.
Yeah.
And you see the wind blowing off it, and that's Pazuzu in some... Pazuzu?
Pazuzu.
Is apparently a wind demon. So that's kind of these real little subtle hints that are playing through. And then there's a question as well, is this the same demon that he did battle with in Africa, you know, however many years ago? And is that playing on his mind? And he's pulled his yoke out, and he's going, oh crap, here we go again.
And isn't this one of these films were really like a bit more behind the scenes reading, especially in relation to what the book entailed, kind of adds to it? Because again, as I said, you can take, you know, what's in the movie, and you don't need to know the background. But if you take the background, it kind of adds to it as well. Like, because there's a great shot at the very end of him in Iraq, where, like, after he's seen the two dogs fighting each other, and it's just him standing on a mound and the massive statue of the demon, and they're just facing off against each other. Mm. And it's so menacing. And as you said, at this point, you haven't heard a word of English, basically.
No.
And you're there, what the hell is going on? But basically, you look at the demon statue going, something not right about that in any shape or form.
But it's really, like, from the very opening, like, it opens with a black and white shot of the sun, and then it turns to color, and then the sky goes blood red.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, I know what's coming here. I don't know exactly what's coming, but I know it's not going to be good. And it just goes from there. Like, the clock stopping randomly, that's, you know, that's such a good psychological trick to put you off, to put you on edge. Well, that's not right. That's not right. Everything's not right. You know,
we also have to reference the fact that Max von Sydow's old man makeup is probably the best old man makeup you're ever going to see, because if you look at Max von Sydow 40 years later after a movie, which would have been around the time of Star Wars Episode 7, like, he's exactly the same. Like, there's no difference. Like,
is that how you count time? Like, by Star Wars episodes?
It used to be by Man United games, being honest with you, right? Now it's kind of descended into Star Wars or Star Trek movies and things like that. But it works, like, 2013, kind of just a couple of years before The Force Awakens. So I kind of go with that.
You're going to go with it. Yeah, he was 42 when this was shot. And he comfortably looks for most of the movie like he's well into his 70s. Really, really well done.
There are the odd shots where you're there going, yeah, like the HD remaster, you're there going, yeah, I can really see that is old man makeup on him there. But by and large, it works so bloody well. Like,
I mean, you're watching it in HD 50 years later, you have to give it a break.
Yeah, it's better at times to not watch these in HD and watch them in standard definition.
Yeah, definitely.
Because it adds to the mystique. The one thing as well is that we were just saying there about the, like, we're talking about a lot of the scenes where you yourself have to make that determination in terms of what has happened and all that. Here's a question for you. Where and when does the possession take place of Regan?
There's a scene where you can see her eyes change, and they just kind of go dark and black. I don't think, like, we're never shown again. If you were making this movie now, she'd be like looking out her window and a demon would jump down her throat and you'd see it. You know, that's exactly what would happen. It'd be like something out of Ghostbusters.
And then the director would suddenly appear on the screen with a baseball bat going, do you see it now? Do you see what I'm
Yeah. But it's much more subtle, you know? And she just gradually starts to go a little bit off the edge, and you're kind of going, it's just a teenager kind of losing her way a little bit, as teenagers do. And then all of a sudden she's levitating over the bed, and you're kind of going, maybe not.
But, like, what's great is that, like, you know, you have the scene down in the basement where the mother pulled out the Ouija board, and she's talking, is it Cowboy Howdy, I think it is, or something like that? Captain Howdy. And she says that she's been speaking to him, and when they put the Ouija board out, the way the symbol thing flies into the mother's hand. And then you're there going, did it happen there? Or did it happen somewhere else? Because at this point, she doesn't seem to be being possessed. She doesn't seem to be affected. No, like,
so she's still looking for a pony and stuff.
Oops. Yeah, and you're still in a situation of like, you know, where is, has this actually happened? Like, and like, again, it's great because, you know, when the movie ended, I was first off thinking like, well, that was a bit annoying. I don't know when it happened. And then I was there going, but it doesn't make a difference when it happened. No. The fact of the matter is, it has happened. And that's all that matters. Like,
but that's the ambiguity is, that's the, it's so good. Like, it's so good. And it works so well.
And like when you look into, you know, as you go by, as you said as well, like when you talk about some of the scenes that are kind of, you know, again, I suppose you have to look at it from a point of view of the 1970s audience, like, and you look at the scenes in the hospital and all the tests they're doing, and like everything is carried out in this unbelievable matter of fact way. And it's not like, kind of, how to put it, you watch movies at times and basically like everything in the world is focused on this person who's got the possession, right, and all that kind of thing. But if you look at this movie, it's just, you could go past the house and you never know that child inside is, like, you know, basically being possessed by a demon. When she's brought into for the medical experiments and all that kind of thing, and you hear the old machinery making all the noise, like, and you hear Regan screaming, but it's kind of drowned out and all this kind of thing. And it's just done so, like, it's almost like done like a documentary. And it's so disturbing because she's been put through horrible, horrible tests because they just don't have a clue what's going on.
Yeah. It's like the first part of the movie is just disturbing. It hasn't yet become a horror movie.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't become a horror movie until like her head starts twisting around and,
yeah, exactly,
vomiting and stuff, you know. But up to that point, it's just kind of some kind of a weird twisted psychological drama.
Yeah.
And you're following this woman and her daughter down some kind of a journey of despair and hopelessness, and you're not sure where it's going, you know. What about the scenes in the bedroom after she's been possessed? The really graphic scenes, you know, the vomiting, the thing with the crucifix, all that stuff. How did that sit with you?
Like, understandably, the scene with the crucifix, all right, it's actually a lot briefer than I was expecting it to be.
Yeah.
It just kind of happens and it's gone, but it's very unsettling. Like,
isn't it?
You're kind of there going, Jesus Christ. But I was reading the parents. Yeah, no, literally. Quite literally. I was reading apparently that they, when they were doing the script and all that kind of thing, they brought in like a priest or something like that to kind of consult and all that kind of thing. And apparently he said that if there was a demon possession, that the demon would actually use more profanity. So yeah, you're kind of there going, but the thing is that works because, like, I suppose I was going to say, well, that's what you expect a demon to do. I don't know what I expect a demon to do, being perfectly honest with you. But what I would expect is, I would expect a demon to be trying to antagonize you, to piss you off, to get that satisfaction of knowing that they've gotten under your skin, and to do anything for the shock value. And you see that in the film, like, especially at the end when they start doing the exorcism and Max von Sydow's character is basically there going, do not engage. This person, this demon is going to say everything to get at you. Say nothing. I went up there, and then the demon says about the other priest's mother, and he
takes the form of his mother at one point.
He does, yeah. But yeah. It's the first time you see a crack in what's going on when the demon basically says something about the mother. I can't remember exactly what it was, and he just reacts to it. And he just completely just kind of, and that's exactly what the demon wants. The demon wants you to be kind of shocked, like, and that's what it is. All the stuff with the vomiting and all that kind of stuff, like, it's just, it works brilliantly from a point of view of you're not expecting it. And what's great as well is there's no, like I put it like this, if you did it nowadays, what would happen is the person would have their mouth closed the whole time. And then the priest would be getting closer and closer to the sea. And then the music would be building. And then there'd be a musical sting. And you'd think the scare is gone. Then she'd open her mouth and there'd be massive vomit everywhere. And it'd be just a jump scare. And it's not, again, same thing. Opens her mouth, vomits on your man. And it's all done so, just matter of fact. And it's
done quickly. And it just kind of hits you with it, right? It doesn't give you much time to prepare for the fact that you're going to get shocked by something weird or something horrific, you know? And I think a lot of, like, there's the shock and the fear and the terror is portrayed really, really well by the two female stars, the mother and her assistant. Like, they're so good. But there's spots in the movie as well where the director did crap, like firing a gun in the air without telling the actors. So they'd get this, like, what the hell just happened, face? And it worked, you know? Like, you know the scene at the end where he's been given the last rites?
Yeah.
Like, that guy's a real priest. And the director wasn't getting the look he wanted for him. So he leans into him and says, "Do you trust me?" And he goes, "Of course I trust you." And he punched him in the jaw and said, "Roll." which would get him sued now or cancelled, you know?
Oh, yeah. There'd be absolutely no possibility he'd survive that at all. No. But the funny thing is, as you say that, like, it goes back to kind of how disconcerting the whole thing is. Like, the time, you know, the first time we see Regan's bed, like, kind of shaking and all that kind of thing, and the mother just jumps on the bed with her and all this kind of thing, like, the scene just kind of ends. Mm. And then it just goes into the next day, and you're kind of there going, like, in reality, that's all you could do. Like you kind of just nuts, basically...
It's like a medical condition of some kind, and this is just a little episode, but you'll be all right in an hour.
Yeah.
And then we'll deal with the next episode tomorrow, you know?
Yeah, and you're just trying to kind of deal with it every day, but, like, nowadays... You know, you wouldn't get off that point. Like, you wouldn't be able to go back to just kind of a normal thing. And that's what kind of keeps on happening. Like, and it's just the slow unraveling of the whole mystery.
You'd kind of feel like if this was being made now, it'd all be in 24 hours, wouldn't it? Like, she'd go to the hospital once, they wouldn't figure it out. And then she'd be vomiting on the ceiling, and then there'd be two priests, and then the movie'd be over.
Yeah, basically. And, like, even when she goes to the priest about the exorcism, again, this is because you and I work in an office and we work with rules, and he's there going, "There's a lot of rules before you can have an exorcism." And I'm there, "Yes, absolutely, yes.
There's a procedure to be followed here. Yeah. Need sign off."
Exactly. The last procedure document had the version control on it. It was signed off there 2 years ago. Kind of thing, right? And that's exactly what it is. And he's basically there going, like, it has to meet the requirements, like, about, you know, like, well, I think what Demony said about, he says to Regan about, well, the demon, like, "Are you the devil?" And he says, "Yes." And he says, "That's the same as somebody saying they're Napoleon Bonaparte," kind of thing. Like, it means nothing. And he threw the tap water. And he said, "I said it was holy water, but it's not holy water." Like, and all this kind of thing. And it's just, it's so cool because that's what you'd have to do. Because nowadays, as you said, in movies, they just open, you know, they'd open Google, type in, priest exorcism, and basically ring someone and someone would show up to the door, like, here to do it. And it's great that, you know, because again, what you're doing is you're seeing somebody kind of trying to say, is this real or not? And then, you know, when he records the conversation with the demon, and then, you know, your man, when you get to analyze, your man says, "Yeah, but that's them talking backwards." Mm. Play the tape backwards. And you hear more than one demon then talking, and they're kind of almost arguing with each other about what's going on. Like, and it's absolutely terrible. Because then you're there going, "Jesus Christ, there's more than one demon here." Like, kind of, you know, in Regan doing all this. Like,
yeah, it's really, really well done. And that's what plays on you, is the just the depth that they've gone to there with the possession, like the multiple demons and the multiple voices.
And, like, when you're talking about the themes, what themes do you think shine true in the movie?
So there's a couple of themes there. Like, it's simultaneously an incredibly dark movie, and it's highlighting all the really bad crap that goes on in the world. Yep. But it's also full of hope, right? So it's the mother never gives up hope, albeit she gets incredibly desperate and she goes to places she wouldn't ever think she would, you know. And you have the hope of the older priest and then subsequently Father Karras. They hope they can help, and then they do help, and then he commits the most, like, this theme of this, the faith obviously runs through it pretty thick, but this theme of kind of selflessness. So again, the older priest comes in, he knows this could kill him because it nearly killed him the last time, and he's a lot older this time, but he comes anyway. And part of maybe that is feeding into what happened in Iraq. And he goes, "I knew this day was coming. I've just been waiting for the phone call."
Yeah.
And Father Karras at the end, you know, with the whole take me and trying to atone for his mother and not taking care of her, and that selfless act of take me, and then kills himself by firing himself out the window. You know, I think those are the themes, like hope, hopelessness, faith. I like it. I'm trying to think, what else have I got? Sorry, I'm glancing down at my notes here. Themes like, redemption. Obviously, Father Karras.
Oh,
redemption.
Completely. Like, yeah, you know, yeah.
Absolutely. And a mother's love as well. So the mother, Father Karras's mother, loves him unconditionally. She's delighted that her son is a priest, even though he could have gone and been a very rich psychologist and had her in a decent hospital, you know? and obviously, Regan's mother, again, never gives up on her. I quite liked the fact that the father wasn't in the movie to dilute that.
Yes, 100%.
Really, really good. Yeah. Really good. And you can hear, there is one scene where you hear her arguing with someone. Actually, not arguing with him.
The
arguing
receptionist,
with the receptionist in the Excelsior Hotel in Rome. Yeah. Really well done.
And I think that's the thing, isn't it? Like, it's kind of like, you know, it's... how to put it, the theme of redemption and hope is so important in this, because so many of these films nowadays especially always end on a negative note. Like when I was watching Smile, I knew a million miles away exactly what was going to happen. I knew for well the possession wouldn't be gone, and I knew that would just, it would continue on. And when a film like this, you know, it's great to show that in the end, evil doesn't win. And I think maybe it's something from the 70s that they're more willing to kind of, you know, say that and kind of in a, how to put it, it's not even, like, it takes the ultimate sacrifice to win this battle, like.
Does it, though? Does evil win? Because this is a debate as well amongst the, not long after the film came out, there was this debate about whether the demon won or not. Well, he's killed two priests.
But hang on a second then, let's, because now that you say it, right, I was reading somewhere, there was differences in the ending, right?
Yeah.
Basically, what is, Father Karras throws himself out the window, but who throws Karras out the window? Is it Karras himself, or is it the demon?
I interpreted that it was him, he threw himself out the window. That's the how I took it, but there was other interpretations at the time.
That it was the demon?
Yeah.
To kill him kind of thing, like, Yeah.
Because I can't have this girl, so I'm going to take you.
See, that's the whole thing, is that, like, the like, I interpret the same way you did, because it just maybe it's just you want to interpret it that way. Yeah. But I think you can decide yourself which way you want to interpret it.
It
too.
Is, like, again, it, the whole film is ambiguous.
But the thing
it's
as well is
super clear.
Like, what's to say that just because the physical form of Father Karras is dead, does that mean that the demon is dead?
Well, as we know, there was an Exorcist 2.
And there was an Exorcist 3 as well.
Exorcist 2 was laughed out of the cinemas, derided as it's unfathomably crap.
I was watching, actually, a review of all three of them recently, like individual episodes. Apparently, the third one is better. It is, it has Kinderman. And what's his face? Father Dwyer, I think it is. Basically, years later, living friends and all this kind of thing. And it kind of picks up with them. And it's supposed to be a very different film. And it's supposed to be kind of much better. Like, but yeah, Exorcist 2 is supposed to be absolutely
might watch it just for the badness of it, you know? That it's that kind of film. Like.
And just in terms of, like, one, there's two things then that we said just before we started recording this, is that you talk about the team that everybody knows to The Exorcist. But it's not played at seminal points of the movie to do with the exorcism.
No, there's very little music in the film, very little soundtrack. Like other than the effects, plenty of effects, and there's plenty of shouting, but there's not much in the way of, like, a score.
I think the first time we hear the theme, the mother is walking home from the shoot.
It's and very she goes, early, yeah.
Yeah, she goes past the church where Father Karras is inside talking to someone. And it's just there, and you're there going, like, it's different in the way that they, you know, the theme to Halloween is used very much throughout the movie to kind of, you know, signal any time that Michael Myers is about and things like that.
Yeah. But and Jaws, this, like we said earlier, you know,
I haven't seen Jaws, you know that. I told you this, you know, I don't.
Oh, season two, Joseph, season two, movie one.
See, the thing is, like, with Jaws, with things like The Exorcist and all that, I've heard so much about them over the years that I was almost too scared to watch them, because, like, say for instance, episode one of this was The Godfather, which I'd only seen like once before we watched it, and I saw it for the second time because I was just scared to watch it and going, this could be terrible.
And
the same with this, I didn't want this to be bad. Now I'm not saying it's bad, because it's not. But it's not as scary as it thought it would be. Now, I know what you're going to say. You watched it at 2 o'clock in the day with the lights on.
With your teddy bear.
Hey, that was my that was my dressing gown, Ed. It wasn't a teddy bear.
I think, look, I suppose, is it? It's right up there with the scariest movies. I think it's disturbing. I think it's a very, very disturbing film because of the graphic involvement of a 12-year-old girl and the things she goes through. That's creepy. I think the music is creepy, and the whole possessed by the devil thing. I think that certainly landed differently with an audience in 1973 than it does now. You know, we're much more cynical, for sure.
And I think we've been desensitized as well.
Because there's been how many possession movies since, you know?
And the thing is, then, is like with the later possession films, it's all about the shock value in turn. Yeah. Like back in 1973, a girl like saying like your mother sucks cocks in hell and things like that. Like we can laugh at it because it just comes across as utterly hilarious.
Yeah.
But in 1973, you're not going to hear like a 12 year old girl say that. Like, and you're going to be like, oh my god, this is completely.
I mean, horror movies before this were like birds for Hitchcock. You know,
it was either that. Like, see, that was the thing. It was either something like the birds. Or it was something completely exploitative that had absolutely no place anywhere. Like, when you actually look at The Exorcist, like taking out the themes in it, like in terms of actually what you see, there isn't like there's not a whole lot of say gore that you'd actually kind of go, oh Christ, you would wince kind of at the screen, things like that. Like when you look at say when you see Help Me coming up on her stomach, like you know that's extremely unsettling that you kind of see that. But like there's no like people's arms getting ripped off or limbs or anything like that. Like you don't see, you know, the death of Max von Sydow's character. You don't see the death of the director. As you said, if it was made nowadays, like you would see all of that in graphic detail, more than likely getting impaled on the glass in the window or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And but the movie's better for it.
It is. It's way better for it. Like, hang on a second. Actually, one thing I wanted to work out, right? The film director is dead, right? Found at the bottom of the steps, his head twisted backwards and all that kind of thing. And the belief is Regan killed him, snapped his neck, and fucked him out the window, right?
Mm-hmm.
All fine. What was he doing in the house on his own? What was he doing in Regan's room?
Didn't somebody put him in there to babysit? Wasn't that the thing he was watching for a minute when she stepped out or something?
Oh, okay.
There's a vague allusion to that.
I think that
a conversation with the servant.
I think the best thing with the director is when he's at the party and he's drunk and he's talking to the Austrian fella.
Yeah.
Never went bowling with Goebbels, did you? Absolutely genius. And he comes
he's a great character, isn't he? The film director. Albeit he's only in it for a minute. And he's probably one of the few little tiny bits of comic relief in the whole film.
And he's hilarious. Like he's absolutely priceless. And of course, where do we know those steps in the movie from? Also,
oh, go on, you're going to tell me.
Oh, come on now, it's a very recent film, last 3 years.
Which means I probably haven't seen it. You know how this works. You see new movies which are terrible, and I see good movies which are old.
How dare you insult the most recent Channing Tatum effort? Season 2 is going to be all Channing Tatum films as well, I might say.
That'd be you talking into an empty screen.
Joker.
Oh, is that it? Wow. Okay. They recycle the steps.
I'm pretty certain it is.
I'll tell you what. Listen, if you're wrong, the internet will tell you you're wrong.
Oh, my God. Joker steps the Exorcist. Let me just be sure of that.
Joker found at the bottom of the steps with his head twisted around.
Let me just check to make sure. There's an image here. Well, Cora, on your thing. Yes, look, we'll just go with the fact that I'm right. just in case I'm absolutely wrong.
What did you think, speaking of characters, what did you think of the cop, the detective?
That was really weird, right? That was...
He's a bit of a kind of a 1930s film noir detective, isn't he? There's a little element of comedy to him, I think. You know, not comedy is wrong. Is he a human in the whole thing? Albeit he's kind of a disillusioned, jaded detective.
Sorry, let me just say, I'm going to correct myself. I don't think the Joker series are the same. The Joker series are connected to something. I don't know what, but anyway, I'm wrong. Sorry.
Again, the internet will tell you.
I know. The problem is, anyone who's listening to this probably hasn't made it this far into the episode yet and has already stopped the episode where I said that.
He's wrong.
He's so wrong. And then they'll come back and they'll say, oh, wait a second. He's acknowledged he's utterly wrong in this situation. The cop is weird, right? Because he talks to Father Karras, and then out of nowhere he goes, do you like going to the cinema? And I'm there going, where's he going with this? I've got tickets to see this movie. And then Father Karras there, I've seen it. And they're going, fair enough. And then at the end of the movie, he does the same with the other priest.
He just wants to pick up priests and bring them films.
I don't get it. And then he says, have you had lunch yet? I'm just there going, what's going on? See, the thing is, it's just, the cop is weird because it comes across that he knows something that everyone doesn't. And that I feel like that he came across to me, and it didn't pan out at all.
Yeah.
But I could be wrong. It almost seems like...
That's the thing, though. He's out of step with the whole rest of the film.
Yes.
And maybe that's intentional, right? Maybe that's we're going to put this guy in here as a... he's going to jar against the whole flow of the movie a little bit. Like he's at, why he asks the mother for an autograph, you know, and he lies first,
so,
you know.
Yeah, it's so weird when he does that because
like it's weird because it's weird, right?
Yeah.
But it's weird because it's in the film. You know why place that in there? Only for, and the only reason to do it is to have him jar and step in, just break the flow of the movie a little bit. And it's the same thing with the chat, the running track ultimately coming up to the cinema. Do you want to go to the cinema? Because you're sitting there going, what the hell is that? Oh yeah, possessed by the devil, go back to that. Do you know? I think he's a tool to throw you off a little bit from just getting on a roller coaster, you know. You kind of have to go and stop and judder. Maybe I'm wrong at that, but I do like him as a character. I think he works. I like how he's dressed. I think he has a bit of depth to him. But he's definitely he's definitely hot one out in a movie full of demons and priests.
Because obviously, he's the main character in the third one, and it's a lot more fleshed out. Apparently, in the book, he's more prominent as well. But then the problem is that you're condensing a book. You know, you're adapting your own book for the screen, and apparently when he was adapting the book for the screen and he was talking to the director, William Friedkin, he assumed that Friedkin would say, I want to do this and all this. And apparently Friedkin was there, no, I want to be as close to the book as I can. And apparently in one scene, he actually told him to put dialogue from the book back in to actually, you know, into the movie. So it's obviously a decision to put the cop there. And like, as you said, it's just, when he asks the mother for an autograph, as you said, it's just the scene drags for longer than it needs to. And he's there going, it's for my daughter. And he says, it's actually for me. And it's kind of there going, like, what's going on here? Like the mother is literally undergoing this horrendous situation.
And she goes along with it.
Yeah, she does. She signs a bit of autograph for him. Like, it's just so... Yeah. It's weird.
It's so weird. And again, no director is doing that today in any film.
Oh, God, no. Not at all.
You know? And if they did, it'd be on the floor.
Like, the only thing I can think of is, like, I remember, Quentin Tarantino saying about dialogue, and he said, like, not all dialogue has to keep the plot moving forward.
No, absolutely not.
Sometimes it can just be, like, you think of, like, the Royale with Cheese scene. Nothing to do with the plot whatsoever.
And like, Pulp Fiction is full of that. The same. There's a whole conversation between Mia Wallace and the John Travolta character. Oh God, I can't believe I've forgotten his name. In the restaurant.
Stopping out until you get his name right. No, we're not. It's the same initial for the first and surname.
Vincent Vega.
There it is.
Yeah, but there's a whole conversation between them in the booth in that restaurant.
Yeah,
and it's just not to do with the plot. It's to do with bringing the characters closer together.
Yeah,
but the actual words are irrelevant.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah,
and I'm going to rant.
So hang on a second. Like my question to you then, right, is that we have a movie that is 2 hours and 2 minutes long. The exorcism doesn't take place until the last. I think it was like an hour and 47 minutes. I think it was. Mm-hmm. I think the version I watched was 2.25 hours. I think it was, right.
Yeah.
Who is the exorcist?
Both of them. Officially, if you go to the bishop where he went to get permission.
Yeah.
The older guy is the exorcist, and this fella's along for the ride and a psychologist to observe.
So then the question is, like, it's so weird, isn't it? Because then the focus of the film is so tightly on the last 30 minutes, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And like, even the main image of the poster is, you know, Father Merrin's arrival.
Yeah.
And kind of that's it. I suppose the question is, right, which is your, I suppose, most, I'll say scary, but maybe unsettling might be a different word for it as well, right? The head spinning scene, the crucifix scene, the scenes in the hospital, or the spider walk scene?
The spider walk scene has been parodied so much, it's probably lost a little bit.
Yeah.
I think the crucifix scene is very disturbing. Very disturbing.
Yeah.
And again, the head spinning scene, that's kind of been done to death again in like every scary movie since. But I suppose you have to put yourself again in the shoes of a 1973 audience, and it's a whole different ball game, you know.
And the whole thing as well is like with the different voice as well, and because like we're not used to it. Like nowadays, you know, anyone can sound like anything. Like, so there's not going to be kind of scary about it. Yeah, with the crucifix as well. Like I said, it just I was totally shocked by it.
Yeah.
I knew it was...
even now, by today's standards, you go, oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, exactly.
As you said.
I wasn't expecting it. Like, I knew it was somewhere in the film, but I don't think I'd ever even seen a parody of it.
Yeah.
But when it just happened so fast.
But that's, like I said, that film, it gives you no time to prepare. It just goes, here, this is happening now, bang, punch you in the face with it. Like.
And then the thing is, it's just, like, they just walk out of the room. And it's just kind of, we're done. Like, even the scene where, like, where the mother gets thrown across the room, and they were actually saying that
she broke her tail.
Broke her tailbone. Yeah, exactly. And, like, all this is happening, and it suddenly just goes on to a totally different scene.
And you know you know what they did after she fell down and broke her tailbone? They pulled her leg to make her scream. That's how into this film the director was.
Like, this is absolutely, like, you know, like, in a way you'd admire the craft, but if you were the actor, you'd be going, no,
perhaps
I'm not.
The devil has infected the director.
Yeah, not really on board for this now at all.
I suppose that's a theme of the whole film, isn't it? Like, there's the line, and The Exorcist is just way, way, way over there, way past the line.
But I suppose the thing is, right, if you're to look at it now and say to yourself, does the film hold up and does it appeal to modern audiences? What do you think?
Let's start with, does it hold up? I think it does. I think a lot of the effects in it hold up really, really well.
Yes.
Given that it's 50 years old. I mean, Jesus Christ. The you know, the breath that you see in the room?
Yep.
That's because they chilled the room down to like -6, to make it happen. And they were that into it. I think the makeup is superb.
Yeah.
I absolutely stands up to a modern day. Absolutely 100%. Maybe some of the other stuff, maybe some like the fall scenes, maybe they'd be a bit different now, maybe a bit better, but it's hard to fault it. In terms of the shock value, it's there. It's there, especially if you haven't like seen all the parodies. I think it stands up. I think it is still a disturbing film to watch. It's still a bit like unsettling and jarring, which is what it's after.
I think for a modern audience, I don't even think they'd have seen the parodies, because even
possibly
the parodies
not.
Are old. Like,
they're kind of 20 years old now, aren't they?
Yeah, because like Repossessed was the 80s, I think it was. So you're talking about 40 years for those, like the scary movie films. Like
again, late 90s, weren't they? Early 2000s.
Yeah, so like you're even looking now, like people might have even seen those, like, so it's kind of because, like, you know, we live through those kind of things, like, so, you know, in terms of holding up, like, is it still scary?
I think so, yeah, I do. Now, I think of the film, I would go back over the films that scared the pants off me,
mm-hmm.
The Ring and The Grudge. Like, those are the two films that are in my mind 24/7 for the last 15 years.
Wait a second. Are you talking about the original versions or the US remakes?
US remix. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I haven't seen the original versions because Jesus Christ, no. You having a laugh? I have enough psychological trauma to deal
no
with.
No way.
This is right here with it. You know, it's on the next layer down. You're never going to be sitting in your bedroom scared of your life of a possessed girl. But I think the disturbance of it. And the
factuality of what's going on, like,
and the fact that the Catholic Church still employs exorcists, right? So it's out there somewhere, somebody's believing in this crap. I like it. I think it still stands up. I think it's still. I would say it's scary and shocking, but it's disturbing.
Yeah,
is probably its key takeaway. But I say that it's also 50 years old, you know.
That's like, as you said, like, I think the problem is, and because I'm a Star Trek fan, I'm going to make a Star Trek reference here, because I have to, legally, I'm bound to make a Star Trek reference, at least one episode, right? There's an episode of the original series, like, where basically Kirk is fighting a guy in a rubber suit, right? And, like, you know, you see it all the time on, like, TikTok and all that, and it's basically worst fight scene ever, right? But it's actually one of the best Star Trek episodes ever made. But the problem is people look at it and they'll judge it based on that, right? If you showed somebody the spider walk scene now, and it's just the way it's filmed because it's shot in such a weird way because of, the way she's moving and all that. Mm. Oh my God, I'm out. Like, no, this is bloody ridiculous. Like, and the problem is they'll judge the whole movie based on just that one little bit. And that is the problem.
Potentially. And the head spinning and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, because as you said, we've seen it a million times, and there's no kind of shock value to it. Like, although funnily enough, right, even if you were possessed by a demon and your head fully turned around, like, it would probably just break your neck. Like,
you'd be broken when you woke up, right?
I'm pretty sure you'd go, wait a second, something's gone wrong here. Actually, hang on a second. That's another part to it. In the end, Regan doesn't remember anything at all.
But she still gives the other priest a little hug and sees the collar. Yeah, yeah. So there's something, right?
There's something there, isn't there? Like, as you're there, definitely. But like, I was just thinking to myself, like, if she remembers nothing, like, and you know, she would have woken up going, right, there's a dead priest over there in the room. The window's broken. There's a guy dead out there, right? There's all these restraints on the bed.
My crucifix everywhere. Is covered in blood. Hello.
What are all these sores on my face? Why do I have help me on my stomach?
Why is my mother a complete nervous wreck?
But I like the, again, it's just, it goes back to small things as well. Like when you look at the early parts of the movie and things like the mother hearing the sound of the attic, and then it's kind of like it's just a window open and things like that. I just love the constant buildup and the constant, we're not going to give you the answers you want. You've got to make this determination yourself. I just think for a modern audience who basically needs that given to you constantly, I think that this would be taken away as, no, it wasn't explained enough. Don't know how she got possessed. Don't know who Max von Sydow's character was and all that kind of thing.
If you put this on Netflix now, no one is sitting in it past. They're not getting through the scene in the rack.
No, because they're just waiting. They're just thinking like it'll be very quickly. Your man will be standing outside at the gate. The light is going to come down top of him. And you're going like, what the hell is going on? Why is this guy running around the track? And why is this cop asking to go to the cinema?
Yeah. Why is this cop trying to bring a priest to the cinema?
What's going on? What have I missed?
There's
something here I'm missing very badly. But yeah, Ed, final word then, The Exorcist. Would you recommend it and why?
Oh, I'd absolutely recommend it. And I absolutely recommend it, especially if you haven't seen like the takeoffs and the spin-offs and the nonsense that's come since. I think if you like your dark movies, if you like theme, if you like good dialogue, it's really, really well written characters. And horror. I mean, it helps if you like horror movies, although this is as much a thriller, drama, psychological thing as it is a horror. For all of those things, this is a movie for you. If you're after like jump scares, maybe not so much, right? Although they're there, right? They're there, but it's not the point of the film. Whereas, as we've discussed, that's the point of some other horror movies. I would highly recommend this movie. It has to be in your repertoire. If you're a film aficionado, you have to have seen this.
Yeah. Like I was watching reviews of it, and they were talking about one of the guys saying like it's in his top five films of all time. Like,
yeah.
And I think at times a lot of this goes down to when you were actually born, what you grew up with, and what you've seen, and things like that. Like I always heard of The Exorcist as being utterly terrifying, and like Lorraine, my partner, was saying that, you know, the first time she watched it was at night, and she had to cycle home at 2 o'clock in the morning afterwards along country roads.
That's a place to watch it now. Like, and on the house to your own when you put the kids that your baby's in the bed. Yeah.
And she said, she could hear like a cow looing at 2 o'clock in the morning. She said it was just terrifying. And that's what you want.
I'm going to die.
Yeah, not over. That cow is possessed by Pazuzu. that cow is coming for me right now.
Ed,
thank you very much for coming on the show again. I'm really glad we had this conversation about The Exorcist. Guys, if you haven't watched it, please do seek it out. Watch it, make up your own mind, and decide yourself if it's terrifying. Don't watch it at 2 o'clock in the day like I did. Watch it at night.
Watch it at 2 o'clock in the morning after you put the kids to bed, and then go for a walk in a dark field.
Ed, thank you so much again for coming on the show. I've been your host, Joe Hurley. Ed.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, Joe.
And guys, we will talk to you next week. Bye now.
Bye.